This is Dr. Bill Mounts in his teaching on the Sermon on the Mount. This is session number 3, Beatitudes, part 3.
Okay, well, welcome back, and we will we'll finish out the Beatitudes in the salt and light, and then we'll see where we are time-wise. How's that?
All right.
Frank has a no-tell policy. He asks when I finish, and I don't have to tell him. So we'll be done when we're done. See where that is. Okay. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Okay. I thought you were just getting charismatic on us and amening. He doesn't get charismatic. All right. Oh, okay. You know, I always thought that the school I teach at in Tacoma is largely African-American. And being prayed over by a charismatic African-American is quite an experience. One that I really enjoyed. The first time it happened, they pressed on me so hard I couldn't breathe. But they were just doing what they do. What I found is that's nothing compared to a Chinese charismatic. My goodness, do they believe prayer does something? And first, it's Chinese, so it's Chinese. You know how Chinese people always sound like they're angry? Have you ever noticed that? That's the intonational system of the language. So my last name in Chinese is not Meng, it's Meng. If you say Meng, they go, no, that's not a word. Meng! Okay. But anyway, so when they get praying, they really get praying. It's fun. I enjoy it. Didn't understand a word of it, but it didn't matter. I don't know. Okay. Beatitude number 5, blessed are the merciful. The focus kind of starts turning a bit here to how we relate to others, but the next beatitude is kind of personal as well. So I don't know if there's any real turn, but feels like it a bit. Blessed are the mercy. One of the central truths of Christianity, right? Mercy. And it's, again, it's one of those qualities that very few, if any, other world religions holds up as a virtue. Mercy is not a big deal in a lot of religions. What is mercy? Mercy is defined as having compassion for people in need. It's really easy to confuse mercy and grace. Grace is God's compassion on people who don't deserve it. Mercy is God's compassion on those in need. And there's, in essence, there's two parts to the biblical understanding of mercy. There's a heart of compassion, the attitude of mercy, and then the actions. So God has pity on us, and so His condition of mercy moves Him to act, and therefore He saves us. Someone once defined mercy as compassion with feet. I like that. Mercy is compassion that does something. It just doesn't sit there and go, oh, you know, I feel merciful. You can't even say that, can you? You say, I feel merciful. Well, you know, if you feel merciful, you're going to do something about it. So mercy is compassion with feet. Having compassion for people in need and therefore doing something with it. And again, if you look at other than the salutations, most of the discussions of mercy in the Bible have to do with this heart of compassion that actually does something. Okay, so compassion with feet. I got a quote from Quarles that I thought was pretty good on this Quarles. I'm working on it. I'm working on my 62. This is from Calvin. He says, they are blessed who are not only prepared to put up with their own troubles, but also take on other people's, to help them in distress freely, to to join them in their time of trial and, as it were, to get right into their situation, that they may gladly expend themselves on their assistance. That was a good description of mercy, of compassion with feet. And of course, there's a couple of really strong biblical models of mercy. The Good Samaritan would be the positive one. He had mercy on the injured man and did something about it. The negative example is the unmerciful servant, the servant who is forgiven kajillions of dollars and then turns around and won't forgive a very minor debt. And the master says, you know, you should have had mercy because I had mercy on you. So the prime positive and negative, as it were, examples of mercy in the Bible. One of the interesting things about mercy, and this beatitude in particular, is it doesn't tell us who we should be merciful toward. And that's the point. Mercy doesn't depend upon its object. We don't have mercy because someone deserves it. If someone deserves it, we don't call it mercy. We call it something else. But mercy is simply compassion on people in need that moves you to do something. But people don't, in a sense, deserve mercy. So how do you do this? Just a second. Oh, yeah. How do you do this? How do you become a merciful person? The answer obviously is golden chain, isn't it? You can't just say, today I'm going to be a merciful person. It doesn't work. You'll never have compassion if it's just another thing to do. But it's the chain. It's moving from spiritual depravity all the way through. The way I like to say it is this. Mercy sees people for who they could be. I think that's a helpful ditty on mercy. Mercy looks at people for who they could be. Do you have irregular people in your life? Yeah. Yeah, okay. I have some people that in my life that absolutely hate me. They hate me with a passion that I didn't know that you could have for another person. Just hates me. And I had to learn how to relate to this person and how to extend mercy, because all the other emotions are right there. Retaliation, well, I'm right and you're wrong. I mean, that's easy. But how can I show this person mercy? And there actually were two keys for me. One was, and I only do it imperfectly because I'm learning, and that is I have to look at that person for who they could be, not for who they are. Still in the image of God, lots of good qualities. Who could they be? That helps me. The other thing, and it's related to that, is to view sin in your irregular person's life, to view sin as a foreign object. Now, let me tell you where this comes from. I sat down, Tom Schreiner is a very good friend of mine, teaches at Southern, writing all the New Testament theologies, mostly books on law. And I was talking to him once about legalism. And I said, help me understand. There's things I don't understand about legalism. So that was the general context of the conversation. And we were talking about depravity and sin and whatnot. And I don't remember exactly what he said, but what I took away from it was sin is a foreign object in your body. And it's not a passive thing. I think when I was younger, I thought of sin as, well, it's just... I sin. And I didn't really think of sin as a foreign entity that was actively, aggressively trying to make me sin. But of course, that's what sin is, isn't it? And this is why Paul can say again in Romans 7 that it's not I who sin, but it's the sin that's sinning. And sin is a foreign entity. It is a force, it is a power, and it wants to make you sin. It's not passive at all, right? And that was a really helpful distinction for me. So when I know I'm supposed to extend mercy and my natural reaction is not to, the mental gymnastics I go through is, who could this person be if it were not for the power of sin in their life? And when I go through that, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But when it works, it helps me see past the hatred and the anger and whatnot, to see who that person could be if sin didn't have control of their life. And what I've found in terms of just how do you go about extending mercy, that that exercise really helps. The other exercise is the old saying, there but for the grace of God go I. And if we truly understand our spiritual depravity and mourn over it and hunger for God's righteousness and it has changed us, then when we see people that are the irregular people in our lives, we realize, I am who I am, not because I'm a good person. I am who I am, not because I have a PhD. I'm not who I am because I'm a pastor. I am who I am because God is a God of grace, who extended grace to me, who didn't make me suffer the full consequences of my sin that would have been permanent and damning. And because I see God extending mercy to me and forgiving me, understanding that if it hadn't been for that, I wouldn't be who I am. It makes it easier, not automatic, obviously, but it makes it easier for me to look at the irregular people and say, there but for the grace of God go I. Separating them from who they are with the power of sin, from who they could be if their sin were dealt with. And that enables me sometimes to extend mercy. More now than when I was 20. So that I just wanted to get some practical things. So mercy is because we're going to get to a very, very important reciprocity principle. So I wanted to kind of pave the way with a little practical application. Does that make sense? Anyone have another set of mental gymnastics you can go through that helps you to extend mercy? Okay.
So I find it almost reflexive.
Yeah, that's a good point. That it is easier to extend mercy to people who are like you, who are in similar life situations, because in that situation you experience mercy and it had a great effect, and it kind of draws you to do the same thing. Is that what you're saying?
And then when my church, different church leaders are like, we have no idea why you're doing this.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, well, that's because you had an experience with the same life.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, mercy is about the hardest thing. Well, loving your enemy is probably the hardest. And this is the form of loving your enemies. Because just everything inside us wants to retaliate, to assert our significance, our importance, our rightness.
And the lack of an object for the mercy. Really, that can cause a hunger and thirst to show mercy beyond our resources.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, there is the problem of trying to determine who really is in need, because we are bombarded with, for example, homeless people.
Yeah.
Say that you shouldn't have to give money to a homeless person.
Yeah.
Because there are
avenues of support, you know, for them, you know, homeless shelters, places that can get food.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your heart kind of goes out to them, but you know, if you give money to someone like that, it looks like he's in need, chances are it's going to go to the bottom.
Yeah. Yeah, from what I've read from people who have been homeless and have come out of homelessness, they say the worst thing to do is to give them money. But let me give you the other side of that, and it gets back to what, I'm sorry, your name tag's down, I don't know your name. Jim. Another, there are too many J's in this room. Jim, John, okay. Jimmy James. I understand what you're saying. And I don't do it. Every once in a while, my wife will jump out of the car and give him money. And I'll say, what are you doing? And she said, I think I'm supposed to. And I said, well, I'm not going to disagree with your reading of the Spirit. But here's the interesting. My son was a 4.0 student, dropped out of Biola with one semester left because he wanted to go to Australia and be the first a professional American Aussie Rules football player. It just was his dream. He loves Aussie football. He's 6'4", 4% body fat, 210 pounds. He's scary. And if he's going to hit you, you tend to get out of his way. All right. So I said, Tyler, just finish your degree. No, every year that passes, I'm a year older. I'm going to Australia. So the kid got on the airplane with some potential promises of maybe someone pick him up at the airport with $800, I think it was, and flew to Australia. This is my son. And he had a rough go at first. Hard time finding places to live. Couldn't find work right away. Got this grotesque infection on his arms. And we finally Skyped with him and he showed us. And we said, will you please go to a doctor? And he said, I don't have any money. I can't go to a doctor. I said, I'll put $70 in your bank account. Go to a doctor. So we bailed him out on that. But it was interesting, Tyler got down to absolutely nothing, was destitute. And sometimes when I see a homeless person, I said, that could be Tyler. I don't know why they're homeless. Half of them are mentally ill, statistically. Don't know why he's homeless. And so I think that's part of my thinking that, yeah, I know I'm not supposed to give him money, but if somebody saw my son in Australia playing his guitar, panhandling, trying to get enough money to eat dinner, I'd hope they'd give him some money. So it's really interesting. I mean, I know you just can't give to everyone, but mercy isn't that concerned with the object. If the person's truly in need, it calls for mercy of some sort. So my daughter gets a card from the local shelters and has things for McDonald's. And she's 25, doesn't have much money, but that's what she hands out. So we just have different ways of dealing with this in our family. But again, that was an interesting thing because I watched my son go through a situation where he really needed mercy. I'm much more inclined to give mercy when I see someone in a similar situation. Mercy is a hard thing because if you give everything away, you're going to be on the street.
Yeah.
That's a real challenge.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Showing mercy is going to church council.
Showing mercy is going to church council every month. Either that or it's another thing that... No, I won't say. I hate meetings, but I know you have to have them. Well, let me get to the really hard thing on mercy. By the way, I just made a note here. The greatest enemy of mercy is legalism. Because in legalism, it substitutes love and mercy for the other person with being right. Well, he deserves it. He shouldn't have gone to Australia. Why drop out of school once? He's a 4.0, for goodness sakes. Finish your degree, be valedictorian, and then go do something silly. You know, I mean, it's so often, especially men, stereotypically are really good at this. We think that being right is more important than showing love and showing mercy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Blessed are the merciful, and the blessing is they will be shown mercy. Again, the question is when? When will they be shown mercy? They're shown mercy at conversion, Titus 3:5. Our conversion is an act of mercy. Daily we are shown mercy. This is the power of Paul's salutations. 1 Timothy 1:2, grace, mercy, and peace. You know, again, we haven't become deserving. We're still undeserving, but God empowers us daily by extending His grace and mercy to us. And at judgment, we'll be shown mercy. That's our final, is that right? Yeah, it's the final act of mercy. I don't ever remember heaven being described with terms of mercy. But you know, Paul says of Onesiphorus, may the Lord grant him to find mercy from the Lord on that day. So again, it's this, who we are, what we are becoming, and what we will be. And by the way, I think Matt said it as prayer at lunch today. This threefold thing, we know this about salvation, right? We were saved, we are being saved, and we will be saved. Yeah, this is not a Calvinist Arminian thing. Paul talks about the different time dimensions of salvation. So same thing, who we are, what we're becoming, what we all will be. I think the hardest thing, though, on this beatitude is the whole principle of reciprocity, it's called. Reciprocity. Blessed, why should I show someone mercy? Well, so I'll be shown mercy. And in fact, if I show mercy, then God has to show me mercy. Because after all, God's a soda machine. He's soda or pop here. What do you say?
Soda.
Okay. Yeah, you have a soda machine, and I'm from the north, so I say pop. Anyway, and I put my dollar in, and that soda machine owes me a Diet Coke. All right. That's the principle. We use the Latin phrase quid pro quo. Right. That I'm going to give you something, and you must give me something in return. And when you first look at this, blessed are the merciful, for they'll be shown mercy, it feels like quid pro quo, doesn't it? It's like, I'm going to do this so that God has to, and that's right, these are all divine passives. So I'm going to show people mercy, so God has to show me mercy, because He's a soda machine. I put in my dollar of mercy, I get my soda of mercy back. Silly to extend the metaphor, but and obviously that can't be what it's saying, right? But again, this is one of those passages where just because it doesn't mean quid pro quo, doesn't mean we throw it out. What is the relationship between me showing mercy and me being shown mercy? And we're going to hit this several more times. We're going to hit it with the forgiveness in six. Well, yeah. We're going to hit it in 6, and we're going to hit it in 7 on, judge not lest you be judged. The measure you use will be the measure that's used against you. So this reciprocity principle is going to come up 2 other times.
Jimmy James. I was going to ask you about that specifically. When Jesus says, you know, forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors, would you qualify that as a grace move?
I never thought of him in those terms. Grace. I don't know if I would think in those terms of that. We'll get there Wednesday. All right. Here's what I think the Beatitude is saying. If I have been changed by God's mercy, I will of necessity extend mercy. One of the joys of preaching is it's not the case, is that you develop ways of saying things. You go to seminary and you learn your theology and you know how Calvin says it or Wesley says it, but you want to find a way to say it that really is your way of saying it. And that's part of the fun, I think, of preaching, is that you develop these ways of speaking. And then it's really cool when you start hearing your people using those phrases, right? And the phrase that I developed, let me get this one right, is that change people live changed lives. That's my doctrine of the necessity of perseverance. Perseverance isn't a new task to do. It's that if you were truly changed, in other words, if you truly became a Christian, God took out your heart of stone, gave you a heart of flesh that's soft and malleable and shapeable and under the influence of the Spirit, and you're fundamentally changed, and you have no option but to have your life changed, because it's supernatural in a sense, but in another sense, it's the most natural thing that can happen, because you're different, and so you start to behave differently. That's where persecution comes from, that our friends go down the broad road, we go down the narrow path, and we, because we are changed, when we go through that gate, we start becoming different. This is 1 Peter 3, or 4, wherever it is. And they don't understand why we're different. And they take it as judgment, and so they start harassing us, okay? Changed people live changed lives. So I was extended mercy at my conversion, and that fundamentally changed me. And one of the supernatural but natural outgrowths of that is that I start to extend mercy to others. Why? Well, because I was shown mercy. And it's part of my makeup of who I am, as imperfect as that may be. And so it's just this natural outflowing of a changed heart where there was no mercy, I start treating people imperfectly with mercy. That's what I think is going on. That's what the doctrine of reciprocity is all about, is that if we have experienced mercy, we are going to be shown mercy. Not quid pro quo, but that's what happens when we are changed. Here's the terrifying part of the principle, and again, it's going to get really scary in the forgiveness. And that is, if someone refuses to show mercy, is it possible they were ever shown mercy by God? If the reciprocity principle is true, if we're changed at the gate, we are shown mercy such that it changes us and we start to show mercy. If a person steadfastly over a, I'm not talking about an event here, an event there. I'm saying if a person adopts a lifestyle of refusing to show mercy, could they ever have been shown mercy in the first place? In other words, are they really a Christian? And I think that's the struggle of this beatitude, because the ideas of being shown mercy at conversion and our lives of mercy giving and God's ultimate statement of mercy on us at judgment, they're all tied together.
Isn't that the message for where Jesus talks about that of speaking to us and forgiving?
Yeah. Right. Right. That's the Matthew, is it 18, y'all? 18. It's a parable of the merciful servant. Let me read the main verse on that, just so we can have it. It's Matthew 18, starting at verse 32. Then the master called the servant in. "You wicked servant," he said, "I canceled all that debt of yours because you begged me to. Shouldn't you have had mercy on your fellow servant just as I had on you?" In other words, the master was assuming, incorrectly in this case, but he was assuming that having experienced mercy would change you into a mercy giver yourself. In anger, the master handed him over to the jailers to be tortured until he should pay back all that he owed. This is how your Heavenly Father will treat each of you unless you forgive your brother or sister from the heart. Really, I thought I was saved by faith. I thought I've passed from judgment into life. Well, context, 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 right? This is how my Heavenly Father will treat each of you unless you forgive your brother or sister from the heart. So what we're going to say when we get to the forgiveness issue is that people that have truly experienced forgiveness become forgiving people. Not perfectly, not all at once, but people who have been forgiven are changed, and therefore they will start forgiving where they had not forgiven before. And eventually, as I'll say tomorrow, is that if people refuse to forgive over an extended period of time, and I know there's issues of abuse and deep pain, and I want to be careful, but there's something about being forgiven that changes you into a forgiving person, however imperfectly. Same thing with mercy. I saw him. Yeah.
There's also the other dynamic that we run into in the church fairly frequently, at least I have, is the people who refuse to forgive. The people who refuse mercy. Not that refuse to give it, but refuse to receive it. And
what?
And eventually they become so hard that they kind of become these dispensers of mean spirit.
Yeah.
They get wrapped up. There's some people that won't give or receive.
Right. Yeah, Mark's bringing up the point that there are some people that won't give, but there's also some people that won't receive mercy. And I've not run into many of those. I mean, I've heard this, but why won't people receive mercy? They want to be right? Is it an arrogance and pride thing?
Sometimes. I'm thinking of one man in particular that I don't have it figured out.
Yeah.
And his nature is to yell. And I don't yell back. So now he comes in more and discloses a lot of pain.
Yeah.
From his life. I think that has something to do with it. I don't think it excuses it.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
And then it crosses generations.
Yeah. Well, the kids learn it.
And his son is like, he shot back.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there are some people who think their sin has put them outside the scope of God's ability to forgive. Yeah. And I understand that, where they just, and it's usually really bad sins or it's repetitive sins. How can God love me? How can God forgive this again? And I could see that's being a real issue. Yeah. Yeah. Jim? The other Jim? The other Jim. Yeah. Yeah.
And thinking back to the very first link in our golden chain, and the way we define the kingdom of heaven, which was God ruling your life,
right.
In a very simplistic way, I think a lot of people see the phrase kingdom of heaven and think salvation.
Mm-hmm.
Which God ruling your life, they very well encompass that, but I wonder if that God ruled in your life.
Yeah.
Speak to their implication here.
Yeah. Yeah, because the way I phrased the question was actually meant to raise that question in your all's minds, is that of salvation. And let me say, before I forget, I'm not judge. I've read the job description of the guy that does the judging. and I can't do it. Okay, that's God's job. And, you know, I'm not a fruit inspector. That's not my calling. In fact, you'll hear my position on Matthew 7:1 is pretty strong about judging, about not doing it. I tend to go more to the area of assurance. And that if, in talking to people in the church, if they refuse to show mercy, if they refuse to offer forgiveness, if they're comfortable with ongoing sin in their life, the furthest I would ever go is say, well, you know, when you were changed at the gate, this was what was supposed to follow. I say, are you really confident that you went through the gate? Now, this is your decision. It's not mine. I'm not judging you. But I'm saying, you know, one of the primary, there's three tests for assurance in 1 John, and one of them is a changed life. And does it bother you that you are comfortable not showing mercy? Does it bother you that you are perfectly comfortable in your attitudes? And I wouldn't go further with people than that. Right, right. And so to get back to your point, how you enter the kingdom is how you live in the kingdom. They're the same thing. And so if entering the kingdom is the reign and rule of God in your life, then he needs to continue to reign and rule imperfectly, in cycles, getting better, all this kind of good Wesley stuff. Did you like that, Bob? Good Wesley stuff. Yeah, if you refuse, there is so much pain in this world that I would want to be careful at saying why people respond the way they do. I'm going to speak in a conference in Houston in 2 weeks, and they've been sending me the sample questions, 250 women leaders. And the questions are, here's one I got. My husband is sexually molesting our daughter. I went to the elders of the church. They said it was my fault and I needed to go submit. Okay, so when I say there's a lot of pain in this world, I mean, you guys know, you guys are in the trenches. You see this kind of stuff. And so why is a person not being merciful? And my part of my answer is going to be, you just got to listen. Tell me your story. Tell me, how did you feel when the elders said it was your fault? That you weren't submissive enough, or, you know, you weren't pretty enough, or whatever. You know, and getting people to, and, you know, a lot of people just want to be heard. And that's the great big step towards healing, is to know you're not alone in your pain, but you're being heard. So, you know, why are people unable to... I know of a lady that had an abortion years and years ago when it wasn't, you know, the way it is now. And just her whole life is riddled with guilt and pain because she can't forgive herself because of what she did. And so you listen, you talk, you get confession, you bring the lie to the truth, you bring it to light, and then, you know, once you've done that, then you can start saying, okay, let's talk about forgiveness. But it is hard. But if God is ruling and reigning in your heart as you live in the kingdom, then these kinds of things come under His Lordship. And His Lordship says, I showed you mercy. I changed you. You need to be showing mercy. If you're not, you have an issue that you need to deal with. Yeah, but a good point, good point. Let me just check my notes here. If I am not able or not willing to extend mercy, then I must ask myself if I have truly experienced God's mercy. This is not a warning for those who struggle with extending mercy, but for those who have no desire to extend mercy and are okay. Okay, so this is not people involved in the struggle of it all. There is a connection between God showing mercy to me and me showing mercy to others. James 2:13, for judgment is without mercy to the one who has shown no mercy. Stott says, page 47, We cannot claim to have repented of our sins if we are unmerciful towards the sins of others. That's a really good way to say it, I think. We cannot claim to have repented of our sins if we are unmerciful towards the sins of others. You know, part of me with on some of the irregular people in my life, and thankfully I don't have a whole lot, but I want to say, if you do not love your brother who you can see, how can you love God who you can't see? And the obvious answer in 1 John is, you can't. If you can't, in ever-increasing, ever-imperfect ways, love a brother or sister, you can't love God. Because loving God fundamentally changes us. That's the only way I know to handle the Beatitudes and this whole issue of reciprocity. And it's hard. It's hard to preach. Because you really have to spend some time struggling with it. But this is how I've handled these things.
Well, I find it hard to preach because I feel like I'm adding words where maybe words don't belong.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe this is simplicity and less than a verse of information to show mercy and the Holy Spirit revealing that person's life.
Yeah. And yet God has given the church teachers. And I know what you're saying, though. What I had to do, actually what made me think through this was having a few people hate me so deeply. And I had to decide how to treat them. Because if they're Christians, I'm going to treat them one way. I'm going to be much more aggressive. I'm going to be much more in their face. Frankly, much more of a Bible thumper. Said, you know, I've gone to you 3 times. I've asked for your forgiveness. I've asked you to tell me how I hurt you. You will not tell me. You got an issue in your life and you need to do. I mean, if they're a believer, I'm a little more comfortable doing something like that. If they're not a believer, none of that applies. And I had to decide literally based on the theology that started with me struggling with this beatitude. I don't know whether they're a Christian or not. I have to assume they're not. And I have to treat them as if they weren't a Christian. That totally changes how I relate to that person. And frankly, it makes it so much easier to extend mercy. Because they don't if they're not a Christian, they don't have the Spirit. They're not regenerate. They haven't been forgiven. And well, of course they're going to hate me. They're children of the darkness. And so that actually is a little bit of the story behind why I... And again, I'm not the judge. I'm not passing judgment. I just had to decide, how am I going to relate to these people? And I just decided I cannot assume that they're believers. And therefore, I'm going to take the safe route and treat them as I would any non-believer. And that is not going to pump them with the Bible, that's for sure. My decision. All right. Well, I'm going to let you percolate on that, and then we get to the forgiveness after the Lord's Prayer. It's all going to come back up again. And we'll see how you've been percolating. Okay, Beatitude number 6. Verse 8, blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Basic meaning of pure is unsoiled, untainted, spotless. Some people think in terms of undiluted. It's pure, that our heart is purely devoted to God. It's not divided. Some of it's not for God, and other parts of it are for sin. Okay, so it's not diluted. It's pure. It's wholly committed to Him. Cathartic. Yeah. The Greek word is katharoi, some which we get cathartic and those kinds of words. I'm looking up a verse in the Old Testament. I'm not texting. Don't worry. Where's my Bible? There it is. Psalm 24, verses 3 to 5. Who may ascend the mountain of the Lord? Who may stand in His holy place? The one who has clean hands and a pure heart, who does not trust in an idol or swear by a false god. They will receive blessing from the Lord and vindication from God their Savior. All right, it's a great Old Testament passage for purity. Just like pure gold is undiluted, it's not mixed with other elements, the pure heart is not mixed with moral and spiritual filth. So the pure in heart person is single-minded in devotion, undivided in loyalty, fully devoted to God, not hypocritical at all. Aren't you glad that life is a journey and that we are slowly moving towards purity? But is purity in heart? So, of course, the emphasis is not on how we behave on the outside primarily, it's who we are on the inside. Psalm 86:11. Teach me your way, O Lord, and I will walk in your truth. Give me an undivided heart that I may fear your name. Another good Old Testament parallel. See, the Pharisees in all modern versions, right? I don't like the word religious people. I don't like the phrase churchmen. I just have all kinds of baggage around those words. I know they're not inherently wrong. But the Pharisees and all religious people say, you know, blessed are the outwardly clean, right? These are the people that put on the show and do it for the praise of men. And what really matters is the washing of cups, the tithing of spices, how many steps you take on Saturday. Okay, and this is Pharisaism, right? And these are people that are focused on external religious acts. And they think, and this is the essence of legalism, they think that by doing certain things, they curry favor with God, right? And we all know these people in our lives, right? They make a show. They let you know whenever they gave a lot of money. They're there when the church doors are open, and you know, I mean, you can fill in the blanks. But I wouldn't call it endemic because it's probably always been true. Is that the church visible has always had a contingent of people that all the emphasis was on the externals and what they did. And Jesus' blessing is on them at all. In fact, chapter 6, he's going to say, all they get is the praise of man, nothing else. You know, they don't get anything from God. But rather, the blessing is on the purity of the heart. I had a, again, it was an interesting discussion about China, discussion at lunch. And because of the history with Mao and the chaos that followed his taking power and all the stuff that happened, stereotypically, one of the real challenges in the Chinese church is to talk about being and not doing, because they don't really have a concept of being. They just do. Okay, that's what Mao beat into him. You know, he would separate husbands and wives, send one to work in Shanghai and the other one in Beijing. If everything is in chaos, there can't be a revolt. So he worked hard to create chaos and separate families. And so here's a very typical situation. Husband and wife don't know how to relate to each other, because life is what you do, not who you are. So the husband gets frustrated and goes off to work. The wife gets frustrated and so tries to control the child. Highly manipulative. The child goes, I'm thinking of one guy in particular, goes to the States, becomes a Christian, comes back, and he needs to honor his mother and father. But it's impossible to be a Christian and with all this controlling, dominating kind of influence on him. And I heard that story over and over and over again. And you try to speak into that situation about issues of character and who we are in Christ, not what we do, but who we are. And it's like they don't have, many of them don't have a paradigm to understand that. It's like we tell our, when Rob and I go, Robin always goes with me because the fact that I respect my wife enough to bring her speaks louder than anything I say. In fact, one gal said to my wife, said, your husband seems to really respect you. Because I'd asked her some questions when I was teaching. She goes, yeah, he really does. She goes, well, what's he like in private? It didn't even occur to her that I would be the same and that I would respect her in private. Again, this is just part of the challenge of the church over there. Now, where am I going in this? So love is defined by obedience. If you ask, again, a stereotypical Chinese Christian, what's love? It's obedience. Well, I do what God tells me to do. So we got to the point of loving your enemies. And I said, what's love? And I knew very well what their instinctual answer was going to be. I said, well, he can't be calling on us to obey our enemies, right? Oh, yeah. So what's love? And I use that to jump off and talk about love being joyfully putting the needs of the other person ahead of your own. And I'm saying this, why am I saying this? Because it's so hard for so many of them to think in terms of the purity of their heart because everything is about what you do. Now, and when I say that and describe it, and that my most recent example of that is in the Chinese church, I go, it's not really that far from our churches, is it?
Well, I'm just going to say, so much in today's world, what do you do?
Right.
That defines who you are.
Right. What you do defines who you are in our culture. Yeah. I wonder how we could change how we ask questions. You know, you get to know someone, and it's real natural. Well, how do you like the weather? No, no, no. So, what do you do? I wonder if we could change it, saying, do you love Jesus? You know, I wonder what it would look like if we just went to the being instead of the doing stage right away. I don't know. What I'm just saying is the purity that receives the blessing is purity in heart. And that's really hard for a lot of people, I think in probably all cultures, to hear. Because we get our sense of significance, especially men, from what we do, what we've been able to accomplish. And so we're all about what we do rather than who we are. This is part of my journey. What do I do? I mean, my struggle is to spend time with the Lord every morning. It's just, I'm 62 years old, and I still have as big a struggle on many mornings as I did when I was 20. It's like I haven't learned this lesson. And because I'm all geared to do. I say, God, I don't really have time to read you and talk about, because I need to write another book about you. You know, I got to finish this chapter on the aorist participle, you know. And it's kind of like, and it's for me, it's just do. And my major journey in life is to learn what it is to abide in Christ. Just to patiently sit down and enjoy the relationship and to convince myself that God doesn't need me to do anything. I can die right now and He could raise up someone to finish my next book. Nobody would probably know the difference. God doesn't need me. He doesn't need you. He wants you. He wants me. In the same way that my wife primarily doesn't want me to do things for her, she just wants me to be with her. So we spend, and I'm really fortunate, I get to work at home and have virtually no schedule. So we spend usually 2 hours in the morning, coffee, we drink a lot of coffee, we talk, we share what's going on. And in the evening, we normally stop working about 5 and sit out on the porch and get something to drink, or Robin's favorite is chips and guacamole. And so I have chips and guacamole for dinner every other day. And we'd sit there. Our nickname in the neighborhood is the porch people, because we're always out on the porch Because, and we bought a house on the side of the street so that we could sit on the porch and talk to people. And it was all an intentional thing. And that's me, that's Robin trying to help me to learn to be and not to do. Okay, so we're really off the topic here. But this is purity of heart. This is on the innermost recess. It's not what we do, it's who we are. And the blessing is on those that are undivided in their heart. The heart's not soiled with moral filth. And the blessing is being pronounced on them. Yes, sir.
He turned to, he's looking for his deliverance. He turned to this passage.
Oh.
Because it was God who said, he was so fortunate to be able to thank God and vision him to have fellowship with him that became a power.
Yeah.
And actually contributed in an amazing way to his deliverance.
Yeah. If I want to see God, and the act of seeing God is an empowering act. Yeah.
It's amazing art.
Huh.
It was amazing that they actually
printed it.
They had to do all kinds of apologize for publishing it, explaining why, and everything else. But it was really like.
You know, we have a series of seminars on biblical training, and the idea behind them is what every elder needs to know about blank. And we're trying to fill in those holes. So ADF just came and did what every elder needs to know about the church and the law. But the next one we're going to shoot is pornography. And I finally found the counselor that's, I think, right for it. And we invited him over. And one of his counselees was there as well because I wanted to see how they interacted. And it was powerful to see how painful and how imprisoning pornography is. And the freedom, because I know the counselee pretty well, the freedom that comes from getting out of that. Well, when I was all over, I told Robin, I said, I think I need to get a fire hose and wash the house down. It was so painful to hear what had imprisoned my friend. So we're going to shoot the seminar, pray over the house, shoot the seminar, and then hose it down. But you know, that should be our response, frankly. If I can find someone that knows how to deal with gossip in the church. Because if there's nothing more destructive of a church than gossip, I call it the native language of the church. That's just what the church does. It berates and belittles one another instead of loving. So I say that because for me, pornography is not the ultimate sin. Gossip is. But sins in good standing, yes. I'm going to use that phrase when we get to 7:1. So, yeah, that's good. That's a neat story. Yeah, there's something that's enticing about the Beatitudes, aren't there? There's something that draws us to. Part of it is like, oh, I can't do that. That's too hard. But on the other hand is, I really would like to see God in ever clearer ways. And if my divided heart is blurring my vision of God, then I just want to see him more and more and clearer and clearer. And that becomes a motivation for purifying the heart. Yeah, thanks. We got the same problem here, y'all, though. It said, blessed are the pure in heart, for they and they alone will see God. The only people, if I can use travel journey language, the only people who are going to see God are those who are on the journey toward purity. And that's not exactly what the word says, but I think we have to do that. If you're not pure in heart, if you're at least you're not on the journey towards purity of heart, you're not a disciple of Jesus. I don't know how else to read the Beatitudes. I really don't. The disciples can see him now in the sense that they can perceive him to know Him, but it's nothing compared to what it's going to be when we actually do get to see Him. What I tell people is that I have tried to identify unique events in the Bible. There are certain things that are going to be repeated, right? For all eternity, 1 Corinthians 13, I'm going to be able to continue to express faith, hope, and love. There's nothing that's ongoing stuff, right? But there are certain events that are in all of eternity are only going to happen once. And I look forward to those events. I'm a real wussy when it comes to pain. I have no pain threshold. My wife never hurts. So she fell the other day, got 3 staples in the back of her head. She never said it really hurt. Okay, that's just my wife. But everything hurts. But I've told her, I said, if this comes up when I'm dying, don't give me morphine. Now, I'll be screaming for morphine at the top of my lungs. But I want to go into heaven with my mind alert because I only get to do it once. And I only get to see Jesus for the first time once. And I don't want it clouded with drugs. Now obviously, maybe if I were on morphine, it's all going to be removed. I don't know. I want to walk into heaven with my eyes open and see Jesus coming. It's just for some reason that's really important to me. So that's why these verses like 1 John 3:2 are so important to me. Beloved, we are God's children, because there's the already. And what we will be, it's the not yet, has not yet appeared. But we know that when He appears, we will be like Him, because we shall see Him as He is. So there's going to be something transformative happening when you and I see Jesus for the first time. One of my questions, I don't know if you have thought about that. When is the sin nature removed? Is it when we die or is it when we at judgment? The Bible doesn't actually ever say. Have you ever thought about, I'm curious, have you ever thought through that? In other words, in the intermediate state, when we're spirits without bodies, are we going to have a sin nature or not? Yeah, I hope not. You know, what are you going to do during the intermediate stage? Don't I have a body? And I don't like that because if I understand what a spirit is, I'm not going to be able to touch my wife, which I like to touch. And I'm not going to be able to. So that kind of freaks me out. Kind of freaked Paul out too, right? 2 Corinthians 5. He did not want to be a body without the tent, a spirit without the tent. But my guess is we'll spend a lot of time apologizing. I think that's a lot of what's going to go on in the intermediate state. Finding people that we hurt or who hurt us and working through. But I think there'll be a lot of apologizing. I think Americans owe Africa just this gargantuan apology. You know, the American church has enough money to feed the poor of the world. We talk about 40,000 children starving a day. But if the American church would put their money where it should, those children are all fed. That's the other side of that particular coin. So I think we'll be apologizing stuff. Where on earth am I going? Oh, yeah. But I want to know whether my propensity to retaliate and be anger, if that's going to be affecting me during the intermediate state. I don't know. Like I say, I think about this stuff a lot as I get older. I am hoping, based on this verse, that when I die and I move into the intermediate state, when I see Jesus, that this change that He's talking about will be the removal of my sin nature. And that means that my heart will finally, for the first time ever, be totally pure. I hope that happens at my death. I don't know. Bible doesn't say, but I hope it happens at death. When we see Him as He is, full vision, it'll change us. And we will be like Him. Now, the downside, and I have to keep pointing these things out, is blessed are the pure in heart, for they and they alone will see God, that without however you want to describe it, being on the road toward purity, they will not see God. And my mind goes to the verses about holiness at this point. Like holiness, Hebrews 12:14, strive for holiness, without which no one will see God. Sounds kind of Wesleyan. Strive for holiness. This isn't what we are at conversion, because you don't strive for that. This is experiential. This is life. This is growth. This is discipleship. This is sanctification. And we are to strive for holiness, and without it, no one will see God. Strive for purity of heart. Otherwise, you will not see God. We were made holy at conversion, and yet in our experience, apparently, we are to strive for the purity, strive for holiness. Not earning salvation, but changed people live changed lives. It is the struggle, it's the reverse of the Beatitudes that are the greatest struggle, I think, to come to terms with. And it, I think, really gets at who is a Christian. I think the fact that the Calvinists, Arminian debate can't get settled. Be honest, it can't get settled, right? This is, I mean, Southern Baptist, the denomination is just radically split on this issue. I know in the seminaries, it's really a hot, it still is a very hot topic. And whenever I see a question that can't be answered, I have to assume that the wrong question is being asked. And I think the wrong question is, what's a Christian? I can't get too far into this, but you know, Jesus said, did Jesus say, believe this, do that? No. Jesus said, follow me. So I wonder what that means. Who is a disciple of Christ? Well, it's one who follows him. I know, if you believe in your heart that Christ raised him from the dead, if you confess him, raised from the dead, believe, you know, Romans 10. Yeah, I know those verses, but I struggle with the language of the Gospels, and I want to understand them as Jesus intended them to be understood. And blessed are the pure in heart, for they are the ones that will see God. Got to deal with that one. Anyway, I beat that dead horse enough, I think. One more. No, actually, two more. Oh, yeah, these are the easy ones. Peacemakers and persecutions. 132, 32, 30. Let me see if I can get through the Beatitudes and we'll take a break. Beatitude number 7 is in verse 9. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called, and here's your translations are going to differ. It's the Greek word sons. NIV has children of God. Yours may say sons of God or sons and daughters of God. I'm not sure. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called sons of God. This is not pronouncing a blessing on people who have a certain natural disposition, or people who think that they should have peace at all costs, or people that don't have the courage to deal with issues that need to be dealt with. And I don't think Stott's right on this. I don't think this is primarily about world peace. It certainly has ramifications at the global level. But I don't think that's what it's primarily discussing. Who's a peacemaker? Three parts in my definition. First of all, a peacemaker is someone who's at peace with God. All right, this is Romans 5:1. Therefore, having been justified by faith, we are at peace with God. So peacemakers, first and foremost, are people who experience peace in their relationship with God, that the wall of sin has been torn down and they're reconciled to God. Okay, that's easy. Secondly, a peacemaker is someone who has an inward disposition of peace. It is what God has turned their temperament into. I'm not much for using Hebrew words, but This is what shalom is all about, right? Shalom is not just the cessation of hostilities. The Hebrew Old Testament concept of peace is the whole peace of the inner life, the calmness of what's inside, harmony, wholeness, that your inner life is not characterized by strife and discord and anger. All right. So a peacemaker, second of all, has an inward disposition of peace. But then thirdly, a peacemaker has the outward actions of actually making peace. A peacemaker is someone who actively works for peace. And this is where it gets hard, isn't it? So a peacemaker is going to first and foremost work at reconciliation. And I would say work at reconciliation in the body of Christ. This is where peacemaking starts. Brothers and sisters together working to reconcile the problems. I had a friend who was a pastor, and he told me this story that he went to a new church, and it was just full of discord. Just, it was terrible. And he got beat up, and they were beating up on each other. And they finally brought in the do you know about Peacemakers, the organization? Very important if you don't. Okay, good. They called them Peacemakers. They did the whole thing, and it was a great story of success. They established what the issues were, what the solutions were. They had the meetings and all the stuff that Peacemakers does. And the church came to peace. It was very interesting. The Sunday after Peacemakers left, my friend was getting ready up to preach, and one of the main malcontents jumped up on his side of the church. And he said, always makes me cry to think of this, sorry. Partly because I would love to see it in some of my own relationships. He jumped up right before the sermon started and he said, "I have something to say." My friend goes, "Oh, shoot. Are you serious? We just solved this problem." And he said, "Okay." And he turned to a man sitting on the other side of the church and he said, we'll call him Jim. I don't know his name. He said, "Jim, I have something to say to you." Pastor friends doing this at this point. This is John, by the way. And the man over here said, "I have hated you for 24 years. I hated you, and I'm sorry. Will you forgive me?" Isn't that cool? That's peacemaking. And it starts at reconciling broken relationships within the body of Christ. Now, yes, it expands outwards. And communities start to reconcile. I've got a friend. He's a little crazy. The Lord tells him to do a lot of things, and he does what he's told. And the Lord told him to move. Didn't tell him where to move. He said, "Get in your U-Haul and go east." And my friend said, "Where am I going?" The Lord said to him, "I'll tell you when you need to know." Okay. They sold their house. Pack everything in the U-Haul. The wife goes, "Okay, I'm used to this by now." And they headed east, and partway there, the Lord said, "You're going to go to this town." I said, "Why?" "You'll find out when you get there." Turns out it was an enclave of racial hatred that was so bad the pastors hated each other, the churches hated each other. They would do nothing together. My friend is really good at reconciliation. And so for 5 years, he lived in this community, worked with the pastors. They're now all best friends. They love each other. They pray together. Their churches do all these functions together. And that's why the Lord took them to this crazy little town. So peacemaking isn't just reconciling broken relationships in the church. It does extend out to communities and ultimately the world. I'll just say real briefly, I had to decide either my friend is psychotic or God does talk to him on a regular basis. And I decided that that's his gift. The Lord does speak to him on an almost daily basis with very direct instructions. Very direct. Assemblies, you love this kind of stuff, right? Tells him where to go, names the people he's going to meet, what time he needs to be at the intersection to stop the person from killing herself. I mean, it's just, and he's been doing this for 20 years. Gets up every morning and prays for 2 hours, reads his Bible, listens. If the Lord doesn't say anything, he just goes about his normal work, whatever that is. And the Lord tells him to do, he does it. I asked him once, I said, why doesn't the Lord do that more often? And he said, because you have to be obedient if he's going to talk to you. If you're not going to be obedient, he's not going to tell you what to do. Anyway. It's ironic, isn't it, that making peace is rarely a peaceful activity. You ever think about that? One of the commentaries said this. It's ironic that the process of making peace is rarely a peaceful activity. That if you need to come at peace in your heart, you have to aggressively attack the anger in your heart or the malice or the resentments or those things that can take hold of our lives. I mean, you've got to stick a knife in there and rip it out, don't you? If you peacefully go at your heart, you're never going to accomplish anything. When dealing, making peace with others, it's rarely a peaceful experience. I'm not a good confronter. I want people to like me. And so I had this really, really hard time confronting people. Because then they won't like me. So when I do confront someone, the two times I've done it in my life, it's painful. Because it's so contrary to my personality. But making peace is not a peaceful activity, right? It's not a peaceful activity. But those who are peacemakers will be called sons of God, not sons in the sense of male. It's inheritance language. That means they'll be fully members of the family of God. And the emphasis on is this is how we start to look like God. This is how we start to look like Jesus. We're his children. We're his sons and his daughters. And that means we start taking on his appearance, right? And he's a peacemaker, and we do too. One of my children's adopted. I always forget which one it is. People are, when they were younger, were always guessing, well, which one's adopted? I'd say, I don't know. I forget. Who do you think's adopted? Do you know that to date they've never picked the adopted child? Ever. They usually pick my daughter. She's not adopted. Which is weird because if you see her, she's a clone of her mother. She and Robin look exactly alike. She's my personality, but she looks exactly like. How could you pick Kirsten as being the adopted? Drives her nuts. But the one that's adopted, no one's guessed. You know why? Looks just like me. Just like me. He thinks like me. He acts like me. He looks like me. He's my son. I'm his father. That's why I love adoption language in the Bible so much. I think it's the greatest doctrine there is. We're all adopted. We used to tell him this when he was little. We're all adopted into God's family. None of us are naturally born. You happen to also be adopted into our family biologically. You know, it's a Hebrew expression. If you're really rich, you call him a son of wealth. So to say that we are going to be like our father, we are called sons of our father. It happens at conversion. We're adopted as a child, Ephesians 1:5. In life, we become like our father, this verse. And at judgment, he'll take us home. And we'll be able to live with our dad. Now, of course, you can't just decide to be a peacemaker, right? You tell your church, you need to make peace. That doesn't work. It starts at the golden chain's beginning, doesn't it? Because you're never going to make peace if you're arrogant and prideful, if you're not meek, if you think that you deserve something, if you think that you're, you know, slicker and, what's the expression? Slicker than, slicker and, you think you're slicker and, slicker than, but really you're a cold booger on a paper plate. That's the second half of the expression. You think you're slicker and snot, but you're a cold booger on a paper plate. Anyway, I don't know why I'm saying that. See, I shouldn't have said it, Bob. I'm sorry. You've got to start with the spiritual depravity. And as you go through the process of learning and growing, you'll want to become like Dad. You'll want to look like him. And that means you'll want to make peace.
Going back to what you said, Matt. You said that it needs to be
Hmm?
Mm-hmm. You know, it's like fighting
arrows. I hope that's not on the video. Yeah, it's just, peacemaking is really hard, isn't it? It's so much easier to be like me and just pretend it doesn't exist and go away, which of course only makes the problems worse, and as a pastor, you can't do that. I mean, this was the hardest thing when I was pastoring. No, the gossip was hardest. Second hardest was when I knew I needed to confront. It was so hard. But peacemaking is hard work. I had one staff member come in and say, I hate that staff member. He hates me. We refuse to work together. So you got to choose. In retrospect, I should have fired both of them. I tried to make peace and it didn't work. But that's another story.
You're a pastor too.
Yeah. Well, I was. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I know you believe in church discipline.
Yeah.
How, as a pastor, did you deal with church discipline with your personality? Mm-hmm. Because church, now Jay Adams would do it a different way.
Yeah.
Jay Adams would slap you and, you know, excited that.
Yeah, how did I deal with church discipline? I had to do it corporately. I would be willing for people to start the Matthew 18 grievance process by seeing me individually. It was really hard. And the whole time I had to listen. I didn't offer advice. I just said, you need to know that I've heard your story. And sometimes that helped. When it got to the point where there was a conflict that had to be solved, I usually went to the elders. And I said, I need one of you or two of you to come with me because I can't do this on my own. And so, that's biblical. But it was, my skin is so thin, I don't have it in me to sit down and to confront you, for example. I have to have other people with me. So that was my... That's how I did it. Fortunately, I didn't have to do it a whole lot. But some.
A lot of churches just don't.
Yeah. Well, it's uncomfortable. And frankly, when I wrote my position paper on church discipline, the problem is if you have a church that's over 20 people, church discipline never works. Remember going into a church that had a reputation of liking to do church discipline, and we happened to be doing church discipline that day. And they told us about a gal that wasn't repenting of her adultery and that was told that we couldn't talk to her. Well, part of me says, yeah, okay, what's the husband? What's his culpability? The woman just doesn't pick up and go have adultery, commit adultery. But the real problem was, I didn't know her. And all they did was slam her. I'm not in a position to help. It's just church discipline, isn't it? Is really, really hard. And it's hard, not only is it just hard, but the biblical, the first century church, nothing was over house. You know, there was not a building for a church until Constantine. And the church quintupled every decade. That's how much the church needs big buildings. But if you get out of the house church model, it's almost impossible. Discipline them so the rest stand in fear, right? 1 Timothy 5, 4, 5. 1 Timothy 5. If I don't know you, you're not going to stand in fear. Anyway. Hey, let's take a break. And we'll come back and do the persecuted and the salt and light. Okay?
This is Dr. Bill Mounts in his teaching on the Sermon on the Mount. This is session number 3, Beatitudes, part 3.